Strangers, great news for those of you who love the show but hate the ads. Strange and Unexplained and all the shows on my network Grabbag Collab are available early and ad-free. You can choose to subscribe to Just Strange and Unexplained or bundle a few shows or get them all. We're adding new quarterly shows all the time, but we always have Strange and Unexplained, Amber Hunt's Crimes of the Centuries, and her show The Catalyst, my advice show Dear Daisy, which is kind of like a bi-weekly Ask Me Anything, except I answer listeners who write in for life advice, and my Love is Blind recap podcast Shut the F Up, Nick Lachey. Plus, there's all kinds of bonus content, including live recordings. Right now, you can join and get a whole year at 20% off if you go to grabbagcollab.com and use the code EARLYBIRD20. That's 20% off your whole first year of ad-free shows and lots more. You can also join via Apple subscriptions. Remember, you have two ways to listen ad-free, so no more complaints about the ads, okay? I have to feed my family. Thanks! What makes a demon? Is it a trapped soul doomed to wander the earth, possessing any poor sucker it comes across? Is it our own psyches trying to break free? Or are demons living inside our bodies all along, just waiting for one thing to go awry on a cellular level in order to unleash a kind of devilish living hell? Is the call coming from inside the house? Welcome to Strange and Unexplained with me, Daisy Egan. Back in season one, I believe, of this show, I covered some famous exorcism. It might have been Roland Doe, but honestly, season one was a million years ago, and who can remember that far back? And I wondered aloud if demonic possession and exorcisms were a uniquely Christian phenomenon. The question arose, I think, because most possessions and exorcisms seem to involve a whole lot of Jesus stuff, and Jesus is a uniquely Christian phenomenon. That's Christian with a capital C, which of course includes Catholicism. I myself had never heard of a Jewish person, for example, being possessed by demons. But my listeners reached out, as some of you are wont to do, and let me know that there have indeed been cases of non-Christian possessions and exorcisms. And so, here we are, lo these million years later, diving in like a crucifix into the skin of a brave priest yelling Latin and dousing some poor kid with holy water, to non-Jesus-related possessions and exorcisms. Humans like things to be a certain way. We like up to be up, down to be down, and we especially like it when other humans act normal. There is a natural level of innate mistrust of abnormal behavior, or even abnormal-looking people. If you show a very little baby two pictures of a face, one relatively symmetrical and one asymmetrical, they will spend much more time looking at the symmetrical face. We expect things to be a certain way, and when they're not, we get itchy. Last season, I wrote about a young man who would sometimes pace and sing to himself at a local coffee shop he frequented. His behavior made customers uncomfortable enough that they would complain to staff. I personally have no problem with someone pacing and singing quietly, but clearly some people do. Some of my listeners, as they are wont to do, wrote to me directly to tell me that that kind of behavior in public is unacceptable. We see behavior like this as a sign of some kind of mental health problem that needs to be fixed. But if we lived in a culture that was fine with singing and pacing, we wouldn't even notice the behavior. There's nothing inherently wrong with pacing and singing, we just don't like it. Here's the part where I well actually myself by admitting that the young man may have been suffering from an undiagnosed mental health problem, probably schizophrenia. However, I still maintain that it's okay for people to pace and sing in a coffee shop. It's not a church or library, after all. And sometimes I wonder if fewer people would have mental health problems if we just let people pace and sing if that's what they want to do. Perhaps if we let more people just be weird, they'd end up less clinically weird, if you know what I mean. Anyway, my point with that story is that we are troubled by behavior we don't think is normal, however innocuous and banal. And in this era of science-backed evidence, for however much longer we live in this era, with the head doctor in charge telling us Tylenol causes autism and babies develop inside the placenta, these days we have the benefit of science to guide us when behaviors seem off. But back before we understood things about the human body and brain, people tended to see odd behavior as a sign of some kind of spiritual failing or possession. And it seems these beliefs did not originate with Christians. There is ample record of Jewish possessions and exorcisms. Honestly, the concepts have probably been around as long as people have. As long as people have been pacing and singing in places where people don't normally pace and sing, other people have gone, the devil has gotten into him. The first hint of demonic possession in the Bible comes from the Old Testament. From Samuel chapter 16, verses 14 through 16, quote, "The Spirit of God departed from Saul, and an evil spirit of God tormented him. And Saul's servants said to him, 'Behold now, an evil spirit of God is tormenting you. Let our Lord command your servants, who are before you, to seek out a man who knows how to play the lyre. And when the evil spirit of God is upon you, he will play with his hand, and all will be well.'" End quote. A piece from the Jewish Journal titled "Dybbuks, Demons, and Exorcism in Judaism" says about this Old Testament passage, quote, "When King David, who was then summoned, played music for Saul, it did indeed cure him, at least temporarily. So if this was an exorcism, a matter debated in the sources, then King David was the first recorded exorcist. It gives the profession a noble pedigree, at least." End quote. But these references aren't just in the Bible. Evidence of Jewish mystical practices aimed at warding off bad spirits is found in documents from the Second Temple period, 516 BCE to 70 CE. A document described as a Jewish magical text of incantation and exorcism from 100 BCE from the Dead Sea Scrolls called Song of the Maskil or Songs of the Sage contains this, quote, "And I, the instructor, proclaim his glorious splendor so as to frighten and to terrify all the spirits of the destroying angels, spirits of the bastards, demons, Lilith, howlers, and desert dwellers, those which fall upon men without warning to lead them astray from a spirit of understanding," end quote. The first century CE historian Flavius Josephus, in his Antiquities of the Jews, wrote that King Solomon, famed for his wisdom, was believed to have composed incantations to expel demons and left behind methods to exorcise possessing spirits. Josephus claims to have personally witnessed a Jewish exorcist named Eleazar perform a dramatic demon expulsion in front of the Roman Emperor Vespasian. In the account, Eleazar uses a ring containing a special root, believed to be a plant mentioned in later traditions, and places it under the nose of the possessed man. He then recites Solomon's incantations, invoking divine authority to draw the demon out through the man's nostrils. To ensure the demon does not return, Eleazar adjures it by the name of Solomon, sealing the ritual. Later texts include alleged incantations written and performed by Solomon, such as, quote, "I conjure ye by the most potent name of Shaddai. I exorcise ye, evil and rebellious spirits, by the power of Adonai Tzabaoth, that ye go forth from this servant of God and return no more," end quote. But these texts were written more than a millennium after King Solomon lived, so I have doubts as to their veracity. Also, it bears mentioning that there are plenty of non-Judeo-Christian practices that are aimed at warding off casting away spirits that are not exorcisms. I think of certain witchcraft spells that are designed to keep the bad spirits away. Solomon may have meant ward or cast off, and the translator decided he meant exorcise because that's more dramatic? Who knows? Whatever the case, it's clear that in early Judaism there was plenty of concern about demons.
Mm-hmm.
Strangers, if you're finding it harder to relax these days, you're not alone. Everything is hard. And if you're like me, you don't want to add yet another synthetic chemical to your round of daily pills and supplements to try to wind down, ease aches and pains, or get to sleep. Cornbread hemp CBD gummies are a natural way to find the relief you're looking for. Cornbread hemp uses only the best part of the hemp plant, the flower, for the purest and most potent CBD. All their products are third-party lab tested and USDA organic to ensure safety and purity. If you're looking for something a little stronger, Cornbread hemp has excellent THC products as well, including gummies and delicious seltzers. All their products are third-party lab tested and USDA organic to ensure safety and purity. If you've tried everything under the sun for peace of mind, sounds like it's time for you to try Cornbread Hemp's CBD gummies. Right now, Strange and Unexplained listeners can save 30% on their first order. Just head to cornbreadhemp.com/strange and use code STRANGE at checkout. That's cornbreadhemp.com/strange and use code STRANGE. By the time the New Testament was being drafted, Christians clearly believed in Jewish exorcisms. Don't forget, our boy Jesus, who regularly cast out demons, was, in fact, Jewish. To be fair, though, at least according to Acts chapter 19, verses 13 to 15, the Jews performing exorcisms were invoking Jesus' name. Quote, "Some Jews who went around driving out evil spirits tried to invoke the name of the Lord Jesus over those who were demon-possessed. They would say, 'In the name of the Jesus whom Paul preaches, I command you to come out.'" Seven sons of Sceva, a Jewish chief priest, were doing this. One day, the evil spirit answered them, "Jesus I know, and Paul I know about, but who are you?" End quote. I don't know how much of a flex it is that the evil spirit didn't know who the Jews were, but then again, I don't understand much about the Bible. But according to Jewish texts, the Jews and the evil spirits went way back. The Talmud, a kind of addendum to the Old Testament, in which rabbis interpret the Old Testament through dialogue, has plenty of stories and warnings about demons. There are warnings not to walk between two palm trees or drink water at a certain time of day for fear of inviting demons. Also, they were really scared of Lilith, whom they claimed would fuck up newborn babies if you weren't careful. Lilith, by the way, was Adam's first wife, who made the mistake of wanting to be on top during sex, which really pissed Adam off. So she ran away from the Garden of Eden and became a night hag or succubus. God, women, am I right? Wanting to be on top, wanting to eat from the tree of knowledge, wanting to walk through the world generally unmolested. Ugh, like, what is up with that? By the Middle Ages, entire texts dedicated to cataloging demons and protections appeared. One example is a 13th century account in which a woman claimed she had sex with a demon who disguised himself once as her husband and another time as a nobleman. Apparently, the rabbis were like, "Well, technically this doesn't count as cheating because it was a demon, so no harm, no foul." Listen, you might call me a cynic, but blaming a demon for your extramarital dalliances seems like a brilliant tactic. I imagine whatever punishment this woman would have faced if she'd been found guilty of adultery was bound to be fucking awful. Not to mention she wouldn't be allowed to own land or have a proper job without a husband, so being like, "A demon did it," is very smart. In a blog piece from 2007, Rabbi Jeffrey Dennis quotes from Hashan Yasad HaOlam, Lily, Foundation of the World, a late medieval Hebrew magical manual, quote, "To remove a demon from the body of a man or woman, or anything into which a male or female demon has entered, take an empty flask and a white waxen candle and recite this adjuration in purity," end quote. This is followed by a very long incantation involving the invocation of many spirits, or just one who has many names, and a demand for the demon's name and the name of its parents. Did you know demons have parents? I didn't. I mean, if that's not instructions for an exorcism, I don't know what is. And this was all before the rise of Kabbalah. If you're like me, when you hear the word Kabbalah, you think of Madonna and Ashton Kutcher and their red string bracelets in the 2000s. But usually, when a whole slew of celebrities suddenly get on board with a movement, it's because someone shady has opened up a center and gotten them to donate millions of dollars. Such was the case with the Kabbalah Center in the 2000s. It's not worth getting into. I can leave that to the scamfluencers. Real Kabbalah, sans celebrities, is an ancient form of Jewish mysticism. The 16th century saw a rebirth of Jewish mysticism during which attitudes and rituals around exorcisms fomented. Look at me using big words. Basically, the belief was that souls could reincarnate in order to rectify sins. On the one hand, according to a paper called Possession and Exorcisms from the Encyclopedia of Jews in Eastern Europe, quote, there arose the notion of ibur neshama, a positive form of impregnation of a living person's soul by a righteous soul, like a saint temporarily joining with a mystic to assist his spiritual mission, end quote. But as with most concepts, there is a yin and a yang. Quote, the flip side was the dibbuk, from the Hebrew dibbuk, meaning attachment or cleaving. A dibbuk is the spirit of a dead person, usually a sinner or someone who died unnaturally, that cleaves to the body of a living host and possesses them, causing harm or distress, end quote. There was a long tradition of Jews believing in spirits and demons, but the concept that a spirit or demon could attach itself to a living person was new. These spirits were later named dibbuk. The belief became that souls could reincarnate three times, but if they didn't get their shit together by the third time, they were doomed to wander the earth as a spirit, and sometimes these wandering spirits could bloop themselves into a person as a dibbuk and cause mayhem. A very early example of a Jewish exorcism comes from the 16th century, when a woman was possessed by the spirit of a man named Samuel. Unfortunately, I can't find any description of the woman's behavior that prompted the exorcism, although a piece for tabletmag.com called Once and Future Jewish Exorcists lays out the telltale signs of a possession. Quote, fainting spells, convulsions, or strange bodily contortions, uncontrollable weeping or screaming, unusual markings or swellings on the body, and above all, a personality change, the dibbuk speaking through the person in a voice not their own, end quote. At first, the rabbi wasn't convinced and demanded proof, to which Samuel, through the woman, replied with his life story, which apparently the woman could not have known. The facts of his tale were later verified. The rabbi then asked Samuel where he'd been since his death, to which Samuel replied, quote, I have gone from mountain to mountain and from hill to hill. I did not find rest anywhere. I entered into one woman in Shechem, and they removed me. They placed amulets on her so I couldn't return. After that, I wandered through the city. I tried to enter synagogues for respite, but the sages didn't allow me. Then I found this kosher woman to enter, end quote. This narrative, part eerie ghost story, part rabbinic interrogation, became a template. The possessing spirit is essentially put on trial by the exorcist. While a Catholic exorcism might include straps and yelling in Latin, a Jewish exorcism is more like meeting your Jewish girlfriend's mother and having her grill you about every detail of your life. With a Catholic exorcism, the goal, at least according to the various movies I've seen, is to cast the demon back to hell, whereas with a Jewish exorcism, the goal is to rid the human of the dibbuk, but also to help the dibbuk so it doesn't have to wander the earth for eternity. The piece on tabletmag.com describes it as a kind of grueling negotiation session between the rabbi and the dibbuk. What will it take to make you leave this woman in peace? How much you got? How about I say the Kaddish for you? Not good enough. How about the whole town says the Kaddish for you? Throw in a pastrami sandwich and you got yourself a deal, Rabbi. If the bargaining didn't work, the rabbi would burn foul-smelling stuff under the person's nose to try to run the dibbuk off. Basically, the idea was to bring forth the stench of hell to warn the dibbuk that if they didn't straighten up and fly right, they'd be smelling that for eternity. Of course, Jews don't really believe in hell, so it was whatever horrible equivalent they could come up with, I'm not sure. If that didn't work, the Dybbuk better watch out, because the next step was to have a shofar blown right in the person's ear. I think the idea behind this was that the Dybbuk would mistake the horn for some kind of ultimate horn of judgment, new band name I call it, and beat it. Various pieces of religious tchotchkes were used in the ceremonies, amulets, and etc. Sometimes whippings or beatings of the possessed person took place as well, and not just possessed people. The Midrash, another Old Testament addendum, describes a woman literally whipping a river, quote, until the blood of the unwelcome water demon appeared, end quote, because so many people were drowning in it. Another passage tells of a rabbi who was called upon to exorcise a haunted well. Unlike Catholic exorcisms, which are typically done in private, Jewish exorcisms would generally take place somewhere public, like a synagogue, in front of the congregation. I would imagine, if I were some kind of scholar about this kind of thing, that making these demonstrations public might have served as a kind of warning to the town. Try not to act fucking crazy, okay? Otherwise, you're gonna get a horn blown right in your ear. Ideally, once the Dybbuk was compelled to vamoose, it would do so through a finger or toe, as it was believed that the act of exiting the person was physically traumatic. A toe or a finger can be spared. A vital organ cannot. There are reports of victims' toenails or fingernails suddenly turning black or falling off at the successful completion of the ritual. Though some stories suggest that Dybbuks have exited through the mouth accompanied by vomiting, pea soup anyone, or even through the vagina or rectum, and I don't want to imagine what that looked like. Strangers, we have a joke in our house where around 4 p.m., one of us says to the other, "I'm so sorry to have to ask this," but we don't even have to finish the thought. We know it's the dreaded, "What should we do for dinner?" conversation. With Tovala, that question is answered. Tovala is like having a personal chef. The meals are so delicious. Seriously, we have not had one disappointing Tovala meal. I've even forgotten to pick the meals, and we've still loved all the meals we've gotten. There's so much less waste with Tovala meals, and they couldn't be easier to prep. In a few simple steps and a scan of your recipe into the Tovala Smart Oven, you're about 20 minutes away from a perfectly prepared, super tasty meal. With Tovala, there are high-protein options, calorie-smart options, gluten-free options, comfort food, whatever you're into. And with my code, you can get the Tovala Smart Oven for $300 off. And the oven isn't even just for Tovala meals. The Tovala oven is a steamer, broiler, toaster oven, and convection oven, so you can cook anything in it. It replaces a whole slew of appliances. For a limited time, because you're a Strange and Unexplained listener, you can save up to $300 on the Tovala Smart Oven when you order meals six or more times by heading to tovala.com/strange and use my code STRANGE. That's up to $300 off when you head to tovala.com/strange and use promo code STRANGE. One last time, that's TOVALA.com, and make sure you use my promo code STRANGE for up to $300 off the Tovala Smart Oven. Remember, with Tovala, dinner is taken care of. One case of a Jewish possession and exorcism happened in the late 1800s when a Ukrainian or Polish woman suddenly started acting cuckoo on the eve of her wedding. She began speaking like a man and claimed it was the spirit of either a man she'd jilted or a dead lover. Ethnographer S. Ansky, pulling from his fieldwork in villages in Ukraine and Belarus, adapted this story into a play called The Dybbuk in the early 1900s. The play was translated into several languages and performed all over Eastern Europe in the 20s. Ansky himself, it is said, witnessed three Jewish exorcisms. It's hard to imagine outsiders being welcomed in to watch a Christian exorcism, but Jewish exorcisms were, as I pointed out earlier, a public affair. Perhaps because of this, there are more accounts of failed Jewish exorcisms than there are of Christian ones. I mean, I suppose it could be because Christians just happen to have a higher success rate of exorcising demons, but I think it's more likely that when your practice is open to the public, it's harder to hide your failures. Also, as Rabbi Jeffrey Dennis points out, quote, "Jewish exorcisms are occasionally reported to have failed. Jews, as always, are highly self-critical, end quote. Have you ever had dinner at a Jewish person's house and not heard the mother criticize her own cooking? A failed exorcism might mean the person died, or simply that the spirit would not budge, and the family eventually gave up. In such cases, they might move the person to another town, or, as some tales suggest, the Dybbuk would eventually depart on its own when it was ready. But also, LOL just moving them to another town. That'll solve it. But successful or not, the practice left a strong impression. It reaffirmed communal norms and the power of faith. As anthropologists point out, these rituals often served a social function beyond the ostensible spiritual one. And what might that social function be? Why, order and control. Don't want people pacing and singing in the local coffee shop? Just exercise them publicly. That'll learn you to stay in line. According to Agnieszka Legutko, the director of Columbia University's Yiddish program, women are more likely to be victims of Dybbuks, though Dybbuks themselves are overwhelmingly male. And victims are usually under 35 years old. Why under 35? Well, speaking as someone who was under 35 for precisely 35 years, I can tell you, at least from my own experience, that I was a much bigger pain in the ass back then than I am now. I was quick to push back against authority figures, yell at cops on the street, or just generally disrupt the norm. Some Jewish scholars suggest that in a patriarchal society, a young woman had virtually no voice or power. If she was unhappy with an arranged marriage, or if she harbored desires deemed sinful, there were no acceptable outlets. A Dybbuk possession provided a dramatic outlet. During the trance, speaking in a male persona, the woman could scream, curse, voice secrets and criticisms that her normal self never could. One could say the Dybbuk performances were a subconscious form of rebellion or a cry for help. Crucially, the community did not hold the woman accountable for the outrageous things uttered by the Dybbuk. It was the spirit talking. Yet, those utterances often included airing of dirty laundry of the community or the woman's own repressed feelings. Legutko points out that some feminist writers have reinterpreted Dybbuk stories as proto-feminist events. The possessed woman, through the Dybbuk, obtains a public voice and forces the community, especially male leaders, to listen to her grievances. If I had lived in a stricter culture, one in which, for example, women were told they had to be subservient to their husbands, be quiet and modest, and mostly just have babies and read the Torah, one could imagine my general pain in the assery might have been considered a real problem. Why, if I didn't want to submit to my husband, what was stopping me from telling all my girlfriends that they too should not submit to their husbands? Or if, God forbid, I wanted to have sex with one of my girlfriends? You could imagine, perhaps, the powers that be getting pretty peeved. I'd probably be in pretty big trouble. But if I started yelling and spitting and falling down on the floor, I could maybe escape punishment and simply succumb to a light exorcism done in public, claim to feel the Dybbuk leave my body, and all would be well. I would just have to mind my P's and Q's after that, and only have sex with my girlfriends in secret. Either that, or I would put up with the whole exorcism, complete with gross smells, shofars in the ear, and whippings, only to then just be moved to another town. At least then I'd be rid of my husband. Or it could be that the powers that be just decide that my behavior is the result of an evil spirit without my consent and perform the exorcism out in public for all to see. Whatever happens to me in either scenario, my community is left with a very clear message. Mind your P's and Q's, or this will happen to you too. And it's not just me making this about sex. Many cultures have rituals where individuals, often marginalized ones, enter dissociative states interpreted as spirit possession. The patterns in Jewish cases, young women, sexual themes, a ritual specialist's intervention, mirror those in Christian, Muslim, and Hindu contexts with their own twists. One interesting commonality is sexuality. Dybbuk narratives are rife with sexual tension. A 1989 clinical study analyzed 63 documented cases of Dybbuk possession and concluded it functioned as a hysterical syndrome, frequently arising from repressed sexual impulses, particularly within social contexts where such feelings could not be openly expressed. Don't forget, according to Jewish tradition, the very first woman God created became a demon because she wanted to be on top during sex. Some Dybbuk personalities expressed repressed sexuality, possibly even giving a voice to individuals with same-sex orientation or gender dysphoria at a time when those concepts were unutterable. The male Dybbuk and a woman could say lewd or flirtatious things, or the woman under possession could exhibit masculine mannerisms, all construed as the spirit's doing, not the woman's. These episodes reveal how Dybbuk tales functioned as social commentary. In many, the girl's possession allowed her to protest an unwanted marriage or to express grief for a lost love in a society where her own voice was suppressed. Scholars like Legutko have argued that such Dybbuk stories gave young women a rare public platform, albeit in the guise of a possessing male spirit, to air their emotions and complaints. Dybbuks often seem to be souls who transgress sexually in life. The possessing spirit was frequently said to have been a sinner in matters of sex. Adulterers, fornicators, rapists, or the soul of a man who lusted after a possessed woman. I don't know if that means lusting after a woman who was in the middle of a Dybbuk possession or just a woman who was the possession of another man. Potato, potato, frankly. Meanwhile, the experience of a male spirit inside a female body was inherently transgressive, raising issues of purity, adultery. That's right, if a married woman was possessed by the spirit of the man, she could be accused of adultery, and gender confusion. Indeed, one 19th century test asked if a woman possessed by a male Dybbuk who coupled with her from within could still be permitted to her husband. The rabbis ruled yes, she is permitted, since it's involuntary and not the physical external act. In case that wasn't clear, the rabbis said it's totally fine for a man to have sex with his wife while she's being actively possessed by a demon. I mean, to each their own, but I don't know. If my partner were in the middle of being possessed by a demon, I don't think I'd be trying to get laid. Interestingly, a 1992 novel by author Ellen Galford called The Dyke and the Dybbuk used concepts from second-wave Jewish feminist thought that the Dybbuk was an instrument of patriarchal social control over women who might have been grappling with identity or sexuality. By the mid-20th century, after the Jewish shtetls and communities were dispersed, you know, because of the whole genocide thing, tales of Dybbuks and possessions decreased. And then people got more savvy about science. The Dybbuk phenomenon was now being viewed through a psychological or sociological lens rather than a literal supernatural one. Many cases of supposed possession can be reinterpreted as expressions of emotional distress, mental illness, or social tension manifested in culturally sanctioned form. One of the few modern cases of a Jewish possession to reach mass media occurred in Dimona, Israel in 1999. A widowed Moroccan Jewish woman with 8 children claimed that the spirit of her dead husband had entered her body. She exhibited violent shaking and vocal outbursts. Despite the tide of conventional wisdom shifting toward a psychological explanation for such behavior, some were convinced that she was possessed. Rabbi David Batsri, a prominent Sephardic Kabbalist in Jerusalem, agreed to intervene. In a dramatic ceremony broadcast on Israeli national television, Rabbi Batsri performed an exorcism on the woman. You can see the whole thing on YouTube. It's long and in Hebrew, so good luck. There's a lot of yelling and praying, and it looks like the woman gets the full treatment. The bargaining, the foul smells, the shofar, the works. The woman ends up writhing on the floor while Rabbi Batsri yells in Hebrew. Reportedly, he managed to expel the spirit, or at least the woman's behavior normalized. The public escapade caused an uproar in Israel. Some religious authorities criticized it as feeding superstition, while others noted it harkened back to traditions that, though rare now, are indeed part of Jewish heritage. Not surprisingly, after the televised exorcism, there was a spate of copycat possession claims in Israel, as if the idea, once made public, awakened others to similar psychosomatic experiences. The Dimona case shows that even in modern Israel, belief in Dibukim persists on the fringes, particularly in communities, often Sephardic or Middle Eastern, that held on to folk practices of spirit belief. In his 2012 piece, Dybbuk's Demons and Exorcisms in Judaism, Jewish scholar Rabbi David Volpe says today we are inclined to put terms like visions, trances, prophetic seizures into psychological categories, hysteria, mania, epilepsy, rather than demonic forces. The change in worldview, a desacralized world, he says, has been more effective at eliminating Dybbuk's than any exorcism. Quote, "We have turned religious experience into a neurological datum. A desacralized world is more devastating to demons than any exorcist." The same year that piece came out, 2012, Dybbuk's finally reached the mainstream when Sam Raimi released the film The Possession, which was said to be based on the true story of a man who bought an antique wine box at an estate sale for a woman who had survived the Holocaust and died at 103. He then listed the box on eBay after a series of unfortunate events. Here are some excerpts from his listing. Quote, "After the sale, I was approached by the woman's granddaughter, who said, 'I see you got the Dybbuk box.' She was referring to the wine cabinet. I asked her what a Dybbuk box was, and she told me that when she was growing up, her grandmother always kept the wine cabinet in her sewing room. It was always shut and set in a place that was out of reach. The grandmother always called it the Dybbuk box. When the girl asked her grandmother what was inside, her grandmother spit three times through her fingers and said, 'A Dybbuk and Kesselim.' The grandmother went on to tell the girl that the wine cabinet was never, ever to be opened. I asked the granddaughter what a Dybbuk and Kesselim were, but she did not know. I asked if she would like to open it with me. She did not want to open it, as her grandmother had been very emphatic and serious when she instructed her not to do so. And regardless of the reason, she wanted to honor her grandmother's request." End quote. The guy says he offered to return it to the granddaughter as it seemed like a sentimental item, but the granddaughter started crying and yelling and told him to take it. He put the box in the basement of his antique shop, but then he got a call from one of his salespeople in the shop. When he got to the shop, he found his salesperson sobbing hysterically in his office. He ran down to the basement, which smelled like cat piss, which made no sense because there weren't any cats in the store. He found all the lights had been broken and shattered glass all over the floor. The traumatized salesperson never came back to the shop. The post continues, quote, "Then things got worse," end quote. The box eventually opened on its own, revealing an old penny, two locks of hair, a small granite statue with the Hebrew word shalom engraved on it, a dried rosebud, a golden wine cup, and a cast iron candlestick with octopus legs. He also noticed a Hebrew inscription on the back of the box, but for some reason didn't get that one translated. Anyway, he gave the box to his mother for her birthday. He left the room for a few minutes, and when he came back, he found her crying with a blank expression on her face. Apparently, she'd had a stroke in the 5 minutes he was out of the room. At the hospital the next day, she managed to tell him to take the cabinet back because she fucking hated it. The post continues, quote, "I'll try to make this short now," end quote. Too late. He then tried to give the cabinet to his sister, who hated it, then his sister-in-law, who said it smelled like cat piss. Then he tried to give the godforsaken thing that everyone hated to his girlfriend, who told him to get the fuck rid of it after only 2 days. So he sold it to a couple who returned it 3 days later with a note that read, "This has a bad darkness." Then the nightmares began, always the same one, with an old hag beating the living shit out of him. His sister, brother, and sister-in-law reported having the exact same nightmare. His girlfriend had the same dream too. Then he started seeing shadows, smelling burning things, and cat piss in his house. Quote, "I woke up around 4:30 a.m. when it felt and smelled like someone was breathing on my neck, to find that my house now smelled like jasmine flowers, and just in time to see a huge shadow thing go loping down the hall away from me," end quote. Apparently, he managed to sell this awful thing, along with all the stuff inside it, to some moron who then made his own addendum post about all the awful things that happened to him once he had the cabinet. Quote, "Over the last week, some interesting, though possibly coincidental, items of note have come up. Firstly, I share the house with six other people. We have been taking turns sleeping with the box in each of our rooms," end quote. First, four of his six roommates had various mild symptoms of what the guy later deemed was allergies. He then lists a bunch of annoying things that went wrong. Nothing horrific. Dead mice, bronchitis, a broken finger, electronic devices suddenly dying. He concludes the listing this way. Quote, "I'm selling the box now for a couple reasons. One, around October 6th, I started feeling bad with trouble sleeping. This problem has persisted through today. Two, I live alone now, and as of late, I have noticed replacing a lot of burnt-out light bulbs and getting many unusual car repairs. Transmission fluid was burned out of the reservoir. Three, I've started seeing things, sort of like large vertical dark blurs in my peripheral vision. Four, I smell something like juniper bushes or stingy ammonia in my garage often, and I have no idea what from. Five, most disturbingly, my hair began to fall out. Today, it's about half gone. I'm in my early 20s, and I just got a clean blood test back from the doctors. Maybe it's stress-related, I don't know. Anyhow, for personal reasons, I very strongly do not want this box anymore. I hope there's someone on eBay that will take this thing off of my hands. I would just throw it away in the woods or something, but I know there has been some interest in it in the past," end quote. Look, I've never tried to sell a haunted wine box, but I'm pretty sure telling all the details about how haunted the thing is and how it will fuck up your life is probably not a great selling tactic. Like, leave all of that out and just sell the fucking thing as a cool antique. The resulting Sam Raimi film based on this eBay listing is very different, but does center around a haunted box, shit going wrong, and, at least according to the trailer, has at least one rabbi in it. But in 2021, a man named Kevin Manis came forward and admitted that the whole thing was made up. Quote, "I conceived of the Dybbuk box, the name, the term, the idea, and wrote this creative story around it. The story was entirely fictional," end quote. Wah, wah. But the Dybbuk box saga shows how the Dybbuk concept was repackaged for modern paranormal enthusiasts detached from its original Jewish context. In Manis's hands, it was more akin to the Pandora's box or a gin in a bottle. But the Jewish terminology gave it an air of occult mystery that captivated the public. The Dybbuk, once a frightening intruder in a devout community, has become a versatile symbol of unresolved sins seeking repair, of silenced people finding a voice, and of cultural memory clinging to the present. Now, with the help of even more sciencey science than the analyst's couch, ideas around demon possession and exorcisms are changing again. It's becoming more and more likely that the vast majority of so-called demon possessions are actually the result of a rare and complicated condition called NMDAR encephalitis, discovered in 2007 by Dr. Joseph Dalmu. The first diagnosed case was a 12-year-old girl in Canada who first presented flu-like symptoms. But then, according to a piece written by the girl's mother for MAD in America, Science, Psychiatry, and Social Justice, quote, "Within days of evaluation, however, the nature of the illness changed. The child started exhibiting delusional behavior, speaking about herself in the third person while being assessed by her general practitioner, and suffered a dramatic change in behavior. While stopped in traffic en route to the hospital to be reassessed, the child calmly undid her seatbelt, leapt from the car, and started pursuing a city bus as if possessed. When not allowed to board, she became aggressive, kicking and yelling obscenities, blasphemies against the God of heaven and all others in the vicinity, end quote. This child was lucky that the antibodies for this type of encephalitis had recently been identified. Lord knows if she'd been born in the wrong century or to the wrong community, she might have been strapped down, whipped, or starved and beaten to death, as has happened with other less fortunate children who have displayed this kind of behavior. I recently read an excellent memoir by Susanna Cahalan called Brain on Fire, My Month of Madness, in which Susanna recounts her truly harrowing journey in her early 20s with this rare form of encephalitis. Susanna's symptoms started with terrifying seizures and progressed to hallucinations and a kind of waking catatonia that looked like some kind of trance, during which she basically had no sense of self. Susanna would be overcome with fits of violence that made her lash out verbally and physically at people who were caring for her. She lost her ability to speak intelligibly or to write. As I was reading Susanna's book, I was struck by how much her behavior looked like all the classic behaviors we've seen in every exorcism movie. Her joints bent at unnatural angles, she babbled incoherently, she was violent, she couldn't recognize members of her family, and when she did, she was mistrustful of them. It didn't take long for her to look pretty awful too. With her head hooked up to monitors, her unwashed hair became stringy and matted. If someone walked into her hospital room in the middle of one of her fits, they might have thought she was possessed by some kind of demon. It took many doctors weeks to figure out what was wrong with her, mistakenly diagnosing her with anything from alcohol withdrawal to schizoaffective disorder. This was in 2009, only 2 years after the disease had been identified. Susanna was extremely lucky that one of the many, many doctors who tried to treat her had just happened to come from a conference during which he learned about the new diagnosis. He tested Susanna for NMDAR encephalitis and discovered that it was the culprit. And just in the nick of time, too. Susanna notes in her memoir the millions of people throughout history who were probably suffering from this now treatable disease who were exorcised or dumped in institutions to live out the rest of their lives. It's likely that poor Roland Doe, the boy whose case the movie The Exorcist was based on, was suffering from this form of encephalitis. But people want to see a movie about a little girl who turns her head all the way around on her neck and vomits pea soup in a priest's face and sticks a crucifix up her hoo-ha. Actually, I'm pretty sure no one wants to see that. No one wants to see a movie about a little girl who just goes through a horrible medical nightmare and then gets treated for it. Actually, they did make that movie, and according to the internet, no one did want to go see it. It was the movie based on Susanna Cahalan's really, truly excellent memoir. The movie is not worth it, even though it has a great cast, but I cannot recommend the book enough, truly. I love science. I'm a big fan. I'm inclined to believe that all those people who were diagnosed with demons and put through whatever kind of exorcism their culture believed in were either suffering from encephalitis or from some kind of psychological condition born out of oppression and repression. And frankly, I find that just as terrifying. But all this just goes to show that a lot of scary shit from our collective past as human beings could likely have all been explained away by diseases of the mind and/or body. And then, where would we be? Who would we be without the demons who serve to keep us in line? Who would we be without the demons to blame our bad behavior on? Who would we be if we just let people pace and sing in a coffee shop? Next time on Strange and Unexplained, we invite Lizzie Bassett and Chris Winterbauer, the hosts from the awesome podcast What Went Wrong, to tell us what went wrong with the filming of the 1994 classic movie The Crow. We'll hear all about the myriad awful and tragic problems that plagued the set and hear about my connection to the movie. This episode was written by me, with research by Becky Berger, sound engineering by Jeff Devine, music by Epidemic and Blue Dot Sessions. For early and ad-free Strange and Unexplained and all the great content my network Grab Bag Collab has to offer, go to grabbagcollab.com to subscribe. That's GRABBAGCOLLAB.com. If you have an idea for an episode, head to our website, strangeandunexplainedpod.com, and fill out the contact form. I will write back. Grab Bag is an all-female and non-binary-owned profit-share network where our contributors get to keep ownership of their shows. We strive to give a platform to those who might not be able to land themselves on a bigger network. Who knows? Maybe you have a podcast idea you'd like to pitch to Grab Bag. We've got live recordings, watch parties, book clubs, and more. Why there's so much going on over at Grab Bag, you'll wonder if we missed the memo on how capitalism works. Join me on Instagram at SNUPod, Daisy Egan, and Grab Bag Collab, or head to the Facebook page to join in the conversation. If you like the show, please visit a sponsor with our unique code, give us a quick review and 5 stars, subscribe and download, and tell a friend. Stay strange. Mm-hmm.